Well, good afternoon, everyone. Looks like it's 4 o'clock, and welcome to the first session on treasuring nature. Perhaps if we truly treasured nature, we would be all outside hiking. But we're in this darkened room, but it's really good to be here and to share with you a little about my views of nature, but I also hope it's a chance for all of us to share our own views and experiences on this important American and increasingly global theme. During the next week, I'll have 4 sessions, all on treasuring nature. They'll all give us an American viewpoint of nature and our place in it. We will first today look at why do we go into the wild, why do we go into the woods. Then tomorrow will be an off day, and then Wednesday we'll try to answer the question, how do we see nature? Thursday, we'll seek to answer, where is our place in nature? And then finally, on Friday, in honor of the 4th of July, the following day, we'll look at what is the nature of America. A little bit less focus on nature and a little bit more focus on what are the enduring ideals and ideas that have shaped our country over time. All of the sessions will be built on texts that come from a new collection from the Library of America called American Earth. It is edited by Bill McKibben, one of the foremost journalists on the environment today. And I hope to make this copy available in the library at the end of the week. I'm John Begellin. I live in Valparaiso, Indiana. I am a high school humanities teacher and also the director of the Global Studies Institute at Culver Academies, which is not very far from Valparaiso. And I'm here this week, as I was last week, with my wife Gretchen and my 2 children, a 13-year-old son, and a 13-year-old daughter Hannah, and a 12-year-old son, John Henry. And it's really been great to be at Holden for a week, and I'm really looking forward to hearing and learning with you this week. Today, I want to look at why do we go into the woods. In fact, all of us have made this decision. We're here in the woods surrounding Holden Village. Not far from here, if you just go down the trail a little bit, there's a sign. It's a very forbidding sign that you are now entering a wilderness area. You may not bring any motorized or wheeled vehicles. As I found out from a friend of mine, you can't even bring in a baby jogger into that area. It's not allowed. But you can bring llamas if you like. And we've all come here, some of us every year for a number of years, some of us over time. And for me, really only this is the second time and the only time I've been here in the summer. And we all have our reasons for being here. And I thought we'd start off with just sharing a few of those reasons. And I wonder if you could find a person next to you or couple people next to you and just share with them why you've come to the woods of Holden. Why here and why now? Okay. So if you can just start with that. Okay, I think we've had a minute or two to share, and I'm wondering if a few of you might be willing to share with all of us why you go to the woods. What are some of the reasons why you go to the woods?
It was part of my life growing up because my parents camped and we camped when our children were young. And it's a place of quietness, solitude. We live in the city, so it's just like, oh, get away from the city.
Very good. Others? Yes?
To live deliberately.
To live deliberately. That sounds familiar. Yes. I was hoping we might hear a little bit of Thoreau coming out of our mouths. Yes, there's a great quote right from Thoreau. Uh-huh.
To treat my nature deficit disorder.
Yeah, a wonderful book came out last couple of years by a journalist who wrote about the nature deficit disorder in America and how American children need to spend more time outdoors, just in free form. And I think we're seeing lots of young people and children doing that here at Holden, and it's fantastic to see it. So yeah, definitely a great thing to cure our nature deficit disorder. Others?
I don't know what the word for it. It's a spiritual sense of being closer to the Creator in creation.
Mm-hmm. So a sense of being close, by being close to visible creation, it gets us closer to our Creator. There's a kind of religious element to our time in the woods and in nature. Very important. Other ideas? I had an experience just on Sunday, and I was wondering why I was in the woods. Did a nice hike with my family up to Heart Lake, and had a nice lunch, and were ready to return back to Holden, and ran into a friend who was looking for someone to go with him up to Lyman Lake. And I was about halfway up the switchbacks. I was wondering, why am I in the woods? Arrived late for dinner, so perhaps you've had a similar experience. There are lots of reasons why we go into the woods, we all have them. One of the points that I hope that we learn this week and through these sessions is that our views of the woods are very much shaped by what we have read. Our views of nature are very much shaped by our culture. We are, as Thoreau said, a part of nature, but our view of nature has been also shaped by our culture, whether it's our family traditions, whether it's the things we've read, or the broader culture that we are a part of. Now, one of the people who had the most profound impact on the way we see nature in America was Henry David Thoreau and his classic Walden. In fact, this new collection has in its title Environmental Writing Since Thoreau. Its first selection is the writings of Thoreau, and especially Walden. The eminent zoologist E.O. Wilson, who studies bugs, and we're going to hear a lot about bugs this week from Philip, and I think the first session is tonight at 6:15. He called Thoreau the father of environmentalism, not only because of Thoreau's ideas about the environment, but also that Thoreau himself was a natural scientist, someone who studied nature, wrote it down, and created a pattern for future scientists. Thoreau has been quoted, they've been built upon by many environmental writers, 19th century writer John Burroughs, famous founder of the Sierra Club, John Muir, the author of the environment ethic, Aldo Leopold, one of the very important leaders of the Sierra Club, David Brower, wonderful spiritual writer, Annie Dillard, the sustainability expert and farmer, Wes Jackson, and even some more political activists like Rebecca Solnit. We see that Thoreau had an enduring presence also in American literature and popular culture. I'm kind of curious, how many of you read Thoreau in school? You read Thoreau in school? Yeah.
Just excerpts.
Yeah, just excerpts. Mm-hmm. Well, it was, Thoreau had a really big impact on my life. I remember was one of my sophomore English teacher suggested that I read Thoreau, gave me a copy of Walden to take with me, and I left school, brought it home, and found that home was just a little bit too, has too much commotion in my house. I couldn't concentrate on it. So I took the book in my knapsack, got on my bicycle, and I pedaled to this little woods called Houghton Pile Woods, not far from my house, and I sat under a tree and I read Walden. It was a turning point in my life, but it was also a point that built on previous experiences. I'd spent a lot of time hiking in the woods, running in the woods, skiing in the woods, but I also had once a week was sent to a nature camp. My sixth grade teacher wanted to get rid of me once a week, so she put me on a bus and sent me there. And when I read Thoreau, it all of a sudden those experiences made sense. He seemed to put into language what I'd only previously felt. And I think for all of these writers up here, that's something that Thoreau did. But it's also something that I've taught in my high school literature classes, and even I think in my history classes, Thoreau's important in the story of American environment. But he's also important in American popular culture. Thoreau had such a big impact that he influenced a young man named Chris McCandless. Chris McCandless is the famous character in a book called Into the Wild by John Krakauer. If you haven't read the book, I highly recommend it. It's a very interesting book, and Krakauer is a very powerful storyteller. He also wrote a great book about a bad year on Everest called Into Thin Air. This book has also been, Into the Wild, has been turned into a movie. And you can see up here on the screen the summary of the story. In 1982, a young man from a well-to-do family outside of Washington, D.C., hitchhiked to Alaska, walked alone into the wilderness north of Mount McKinley. He had given away $25,000 to Oxfam and abandoned his car, most of his possessions, invented a new life for himself. 4 months later, his decomposed body was found by a moose hunter. In his possessions, in this old Anchorage city bus, were a collection of books. One of them had a highlighted passage in it from Thoreau. Rather than love, than money, than fame, give me truth. I sat at a table where rich food and wine was in abundance and obsequious attendance, but sincerity and truth were not. And I went away hungry from the inhospitable board. The hospitality was as cold as the ices. And this is from Thoreau's Walden. At the top of the page, just like I teach my students to do, to highlight and to write words on their readings, Chris wrote the word in capital letters, truth. In some ways, Thoreau could not have been more proud, but it was an extreme version of taking Thoreau very, very seriously. Probably more seriously than Thoreau ever took his own experiences. Now, there are less serious views of Thoreau. On the right, you see a cartoon. This is my family going to Stehekin to get a hamburger.
Okay. We've done it. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. We've all, yeah, many of us have done this. Okay. A lot of environmental writers today have talked about how we don't all live up to the environmental standards, and I'm one of them. Here I am. That's me. Maybe not me, but maybe other people here on the lake, right? Yes, Thoreau had it right. Let's build a big house with a big garage right on the pond. The house, obviously, bigger than the pond itself.
Yeah. Right? I mean,
this is a very American way of handling nature, isn't it? That's one. Oops. Now, America is a commercial culture, after all, so people have also taken used Thoreau to make money. Here's a t-shirt you can buy for $25.95 from the Cafe Press. And I love this quote, and you think about this being commercial, right? Because they're selling this t-shirt saying it's not commercial. We, right, quote Thoreau, "We make ourselves rich by making our wants few." Very apropos for these times. Okay? A rich and thoughtful gift for all. And if we really didn't need more possessions, we wouldn't need to buy this t-shirt.
Right.
And here is a great maternity t-shirt.
Oh, gosh.
I don't It's just so funny how things get shaped in our culture, right? Here's a very famous Thoreau quote: "Most men lead lives of quiet desperation and go to the grave with the song still in them." A very strange quote for a pregnant mother. You think it'd be a little more hopeful. And this one I really like. This is a greeting card you can buy. If Thoreau really wanted to simplify, why did he have to write "simplify" so many times? They're just written at once. It would have been enough. Right? And he didn't need that first and middle name either. But you can buy this card for just a few bucks. Okay.
$3.70.
Yes. Here's another one. This is me getting ready for this session. Okay. Right here I am in the woods of Walden with my computer.
Yeah. Right.
What's it called? It's very strange. Okay. And here is another one. I couldn't get a good image of it, but I liked it well enough I thought I'd try to put it in words. This is a New Yorker cartoon by J.B. Handelsman. And it depicts Thoreau sitting by Walden Pond writing a postcard. The caption underneath this picture says, "Strategic use of postcards. Thoreau manages to keep Walden Pond unspoiled." And the letter reads, "Dear Ralph," this is obviously to Ralph Waldo Emerson's good friend, "talk about boring, nothing to do but take stupid walks in the dreary woods. You'd hate it. Best regards, Henry." If you've ever been to Walden Pond outside Concord, Massachusetts, I think you'd really understand this. It's in the summertime, it's crowded with beach and pond lovers. Just literally hundreds of people crawling along the shores of Walden Pond. And I think it's an example of how Americans sometimes have loved nature to death. I just made a visit to Yellowstone Park, and there there's thousands of people staring at a waterfall that barely compares to some of the ones that we can see in the valley here. Now, some of us may not remember the story, so I thought I'd have a quick refresher. But just a quick survey. How many of you have, I asked already, how many of you read Thoreau or in school? How many of you have read Walden before? Okay, a few, okay. Well, for those of you who haven't read it or haven't read it in a long time, I found a quick refresher course for you. This is a wonderful book by a great artist, D.B. Johnson. This is a book I've seen philosophy teachers use in their classes. It's a very simple retelling of the story. From the point of view of a bear. It's called Henry Builds a Cabin. One day, I'm going to ask you to pay very close attention because we're going to use this afterwards. There might be a little quiz. So, a little pressure on you. I'm a high school teacher, right? So it's got to have the pressure of the possible pop quiz. So, one spring day, Henry decided to build a cabin. He borrowed an axe and cut down 12 trees. Henry cut the logs into square beams. He notched the bottom beams to fit into corner posts. The corner posts fit into ceiling beams, and the ceiling beams fit into roof beams. In April, his friend Emerson helped raise the beams. The work made him hungry, right? "Henry," he said, "your cabin looks too small to eat in." "It's bigger than it looks," said Henry. It's kind of like the rooms at Holden. They're bigger than they And he led his friend to a bean patch, and he planted a bean patch he had planted behind the cabin. "When it's finished, this will be my dining room." In May, Henry bought an old shed and took it apart. He nailed the boards on the floor, the roof, and the walls of his cabin. Henry was nailing the last board when his friend Alcott arrived. "What are you doing, Henry?" "Henry," he said, "your cabin looks too dark to read in." "It's brighter than it looks," said Henry. And he led his friend to a sunny spot beside the cabin. "When it's finished, this will be my library." We have a library, I think, out here, like In June, Henry put a door in front. Then he put two used windows in the side walls. He bought old shingles for the roof and walls. Henry was nailing the last shingle when Miss Lydia peeked in the window. "Henry," she said, "your cabin looks too small to dance in." "It's bigger than it looks," said Henry. And he led her to the front of the cabin, where a path curved down to the pond. "When it's finished, this will be the ballroom with a grand stairway." On the 4th of July, Henry moved into his cabin. He ate beans in his dining room. He read in his library, and he danced down the grand stairway to the pond. When it started to rain, Henry ran back to his cabin. "It's bigger than it looks," he said. "This is just the room I wear when it's raining." This is just a little background on the book that shows that although this is looks like a children's story, it's really the whole story in miniature. Quiz question. When did he move into the cabin? July 4th, 1845. Now, why would that be significant?
Was that the start of the Mexican War?
Pretty close, but it's July. It's not the year that's so important. It's the day, July 4th, right? So he's moving to this cabin. He's kind of declaring his independence.
Oh.
Right? He's declaring his independence. I'm free. Now, some people have studied the life of Thoreau and Emerson. I'm not a scholar of either, but I've read some of the work. And many have pointed out how Thoreau was particularly irritated by all the time that he spent at Emerson's house. In fact, he often lived in a room upstairs. And we could see that in a quote about that Chris McCandless in Alaska had in his possession. Right? There were lots of meals he had at Emerson's he didn't really well like. We also know that Emerson's household was much bigger than an average household. He had a lot of children, a lot of other people. It was a very busy place. I think it's not a surprise that Thoreau would want to escape there and build himself a little cabin in the woods. It's also not surprising that Emerson himself would talk about individualism and self-reliance. The one thing Emerson wanted was just have a little quiet time. He was a father with busy children and all. I actually can identify with that too. I'd like to have a little peace and quiet now and then. And I think Thoreau was hoping to find that. Another quiz question. Why did Henry build this cabin? Why did he do it? How about do another one? What were some of the features that he was very proud of in the cabin? What did it have? What did the cabin have?
It was big enough to suit him.
It was big enough to suit him.
Made of used materials.
Made of used materials. Very important to Thoreau. It wasn't going to cost him much money. It was inexpensive.
He did it himself.
It has the things that he likes. What are the things he likes to do?
Read.
Dance.
Eat. Very good. Excellent. Now, I think to get at why Thoreau went to the woods, I think it might be best to actually read a little Thoreau. Here is a picture on your left of the very front piece of the book. This is the original edition of Walden or Life in the Woods, and it was published in 1854. Notice anything? It was published in 1854. But he went to the woods in 1845. So there's quite a bit of time between the time he went to the woods and the time he actually published the book. Mm-hmm. All right. And here on the right is a reconstruction of the cabin that you can find at Walden Pond, mm-hmm. which is a state park and a beach place for people in the summer, and a very small pond. So if you could, now if everyone could look at the selection I handed out at the beginning. If anyone doesn't have a copy, I'll give you one now. So I want you to imagine that you're in this little cabin in the woods, and just like Henry, you like to read. So you can take a little moment to read. I heard a great quote last night that I hope to share with my students next year. It was a quote that was on the original library here at Holden. And the quote was, "Read slowly." Read slowly. And I'd like you to take a moment to do that. I want you to read this selection slowly and to take note of why Thoreau goes to the woods. Why does he go there? And this little bit of an explanation of this excerpt. It comes from this book, so it's not the complete work. In the you'll see a little on the very first page. You'll notice the first page because it says page 18, and at the top it says "From American Earth." So that's the very first page. The first three paragraphs you see there come from the first chapter, Economy. And you don't need to read those three paragraphs. I'd like you to start at the asterisks, those little stars. That's the excerpt beginning from chapter 2, which is Life in the Woods. Okay, so if you start there, you'll get his bang, almost thesis statement. But then it gets a little bit more interesting from there, so I'd like you to just read it very, very slowly and carefully. In the interest of time, let's just stop wherever you are here. And you've now made it in and out of the thick ideas of transcendentalism. Some of it is very clear. Some of it is perhaps not as clear as you'd like. Some of that has to do with the complexity of the ideas he's trying to communicate. And other of it has to do with just the active imagination it requires for us to go back 150 years and read somebody else's writing from them. So let's just talk as a big group about why did Thoreau go to the woods? What are some of the reasons he gives for going to the woods? We'll start halfway down the page of 19 and look real closely there. We've heard one of the words already today. He wanted to live deliberately. He said, "I went to the woods because I wished to live deliberately." What does that mean, to live deliberately?
Think about what you're doing.
Think about what you're doing.
And do it on purpose.
Yeah, do it, everything on purpose. We saw that in the story, right? Everything that this Henry does, he's doing for a specific reason. And he's doing it very carefully. He's thought it out. And although the scale of this house seems so much smaller than everybody else at the time, he knows what he's about. Okay? Now look at what he says right after the word deliberately. He defines what he means by deliberately. Okay? Comma. "To front only the essential facts of life and to see if I could learn what it had to teach. And not, when I came to die, discover that I had not lived." What does he mean by that?
I suppose in today's lingo, it would be to live proactively rather than reactively. And one's own personal choice to embrace one wants to live rather than just somebody else's agenda.
So what does he mean by that living? You said you went to the woods to live deliberately. What does Thoreau mean by that?
To not be consumed by the excess and to be clouded with stuff that's not essential and to have clarity without distractions of things that are really important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very good summary. What if we can find some other quotes that Thoreau uses to define what he means by deliberately?
Well, he says simplify, simplify, simplify. That's one of his themes. It's just stuff. You don't need it. Get rid of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very good. Simplify, simplify, simplify. He really wants to simplify. He says it many times, not just in one row. This would be the next page. So if you go to page 20 and you go down about 9 lines, you'll see this just barrage of simplifies. Right? 3 right in a row, followed by an exclamation point. And if you still didn't get the message, halfway down the page, just a few more lines down, he says it 2 more times. Mm-hmm. Right? He wants us to get that idea. That is something that's very much on his mind. I hope I can say a few more words about that in a minute. What else does he mean by living deliberately? What are some of the other things that he says that he means besides?
He wants to suck the marrow out of life.
Yeah. This is one of the all-time great Thoreau quotes, isn't it?
Meaty, earthy. Yeah. And then he also says that he wants to, he doesn't say whether life is mean or not, but he's going to find out if it is, and if it is, he's going to publish it.
Mm-hmm. Oh. Now, what does he mean by mean? This word mean. This is on the bottom of page 19. This isn't a word that we use a lot nowadays.
Seems like it's a little bit like, at least the way he uses it, opposite of sublime. Wherein that might be beautiful and ugly, or bitter and sweet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's right.
Despair or joyous. Mm-hmm.
So he's going to find out what life's really all about. Whether it's something that is a low thing or something that is a really high, elevated, sublime thing. This word sublime is really a big word in the early 19th century. It comes out of Romanticism. It's also, it comes from Europe. The Romantics there, but also comes through Emerson to Thoreau. And he's constantly doing he's making dichotomies, he's making contrasts all the time. This is part of his logic. It's almost a dialectic that he's got. The mean versus sublime. Living a full life, not living a full life. It's going back and forth throughout the whole book. He makes these contrasts between things. Contrasts between the free individual and the more corrupt society. Okay. Anybody find any other quotes that they like that sum up what or suggest what Thoreau means by living deliberately and why he went to the woods? Why do we need to simplify? What's wrong with the complex modern life?
Takes too much junk.
Junk.
Takes up too much of your time.
Takes up too much time.
And your money.
And your money.
It's not real.
Excuse me?
It's not real.
And it's not real, right? It's not reality.
It's depleting resources.
In the very first chapter, he talks a lot about the economics of this choice. Mm-hmm. And even talks about how it's much cheaper to just walk to Fitchburg than it is to get a job to make the money to pay for the train to go to Fitchburg. You'd get there faster if you just walked. Right? This is a real key economic point that he makes. But he also says, this is on page 20 near the top, he says, our life is frittered away, it's down 8 lines. Our life is frittered away by detail.
Right. Junk.
Do you ever feel that way?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right? We're living Thoreau's life still.
It's the reason you don't buy a fur coat. Truly. Because it just takes up so much time. And they're so heavy. And you have to put them in storage. And you have to go to a professional to clean them. And it's just like ridiculous.
Yeah, I'm a sailor. That's why I wouldn't buy a boat.
Right, exactly.
It takes too much, right? You get so worried about all the details, you miss the real meaning of life. And I think Thoreau still speaks to us today, still speaks to our crowded lives.
But what I don't hear is what you ought to be doing instead of all of this, and what is this real meaning of life?
Does he get there anywhere? Did anyone see anywhere that he gets there?
I didn't.
You did?
Yeah. Well, he says reality is fabulous, but he doesn't define reality.
Mm-hmm. Okay. He does say that, like, God isn't, he doesn't say it this way, he says God's in the present moment, and I think that's a big part of it. Mm-hmm. Being in the present moment.
Mm-hmm. Let's take this point and build on it a little bit. What are the things, let's say if he doesn't say exactly how we're supposed to live, he says how we're not supposed to live, what are some of the things that he does not like, that he'd like to get rid of? Get in the way of things. Excuse me?
Three meals a day.
Three meals a day. The post office. What doesn't he like about the post office?
Don't send the guy a birthday card. Because he's not going to appreciate it. It's not even worth a penny. It costs a meal.
It makes that card I showed earlier even more ironic. Right? Yeah. There's a guy who didn't even like the post office. And now they're making cards, right? Mm-hmm. He also doesn't like newspapers. What's wrong with newspapers?
Mad at trees.
Mad at trees?
Yeah.
gossip on the one hand, but, and this is something that in a way, and I haven't read this for years, but I guess I had a more romantic memory of it. But in the section on newspapers here, the gossip I kind of got, but it really sort of bothered me, the language about, you know, I don't want to hear about all that stuff in Europe because it's the same old, same old.
The same old, same old. Very good.
Yeah, I find there's, I mean, to me it almost comes across as hypocrisy, though. He talks about the simple life, and yet he himself, in the way he writes and the examples he uses and the quotes, shows his own erudition. And how did he acquire that through such, you know, devoted simplicity?
He went to Yiddish. We have this here at Holden, don't we? Where we have a kind of a news blackout. Have you enjoyed that?
Yeah.
Right. Have you been able to live without it?
Yeah.
Maybe Thoreau's onto something.
Emily says once you've read it, it's the same. Isn't that what he says?
Mm-hmm, that's right. Exactly right. That's how I read it too.
The murder and mayhem that's on the news every night.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same story again and again. Just different names connected with it.
Mm-hmm. He says on the bottom of page 22, there's nothing, nothing new that's ever happened in foreign parts, except French Revolution.
Yeah, right.
Maybe. Yeah, let's go down to 24. We're quickly running out of time here. So we go to, on 24, he makes a number of references actually on 23 and 24, which are interesting because of their importance in American culture. He makes a reference to a character from Confucius. This is that Kuang Su character. So he's reading some other kinds of philosophy besides Western philosophy. He's reacting against Christian philosophy. You may have noticed earlier he talks about how he doesn't really have much time for the Westminster Confession, which is the Calvinist book that would have been of his Puritan forefathers. And then also on 23 going to 24, he makes a reference to Hinduism and to Brahma, the Hindu god of creation, okay, which is an interesting thing because he's trying to find truth in creation. Then he has another one of great quotes. This is the first full paragraph on 24, just past the halfway point. He says, "Let us spend one day as deliberately as nature, and not be thrown off the track by every nutshell and mosquito's wing that falls on the rails." I think he's making a reference to railroads, but he's also doing a very transcendental thing. That transcendental thing is using nature as a metaphor for truth. Nature somehow has in it what we need to know. This actually comes from a journal entry that he wrote. He wrote in this journal entry, "I have a room all to myself. It's nature. I have a room all to myself. It's nature." I think that's one of the great points that the cartoonist made in the book that we saw a little bit earlier. Then on the bottom of 24, there are a lot of things that bother him again. It's a kind of continuation of things that he saw on page 20. But he talks about the engine whistle, okay, and the bell that rings. What's he referring to there? And and it's the same thing that the insect falls into the rails. What's he talking about there? It's really something that really bothers him. Where would he hear the whistle and the engine? What is that?
Railroad.
It's a railroad. In fact, the year previous to 1844, the railroad made it to Concord, right there by the pond. I've actually walked around the pond. The railway line is within 100 yards of one end of the pond. And so he's really irritated by this. Four times a day, the train comes by. And Concord is no longer this distant place, the place where the Minutemen fought the British in the Revolution, the first moment of independence for America. He's mad about that. He'd like to get rid of that. And a lot of other things he'd like to get rid of. Then we go to the very last paragraph. This is one of the last quotes. He says, this very famous quote, "Time is but the stream I go a fishing in." What does he mean by that? It's a beautiful, beautiful line. Time is but a stream I go a fishing in.
He lives outside of time, or time doesn't really, I don't know, that there's distance there. There's, I'm not a part of it, but I'll tap into it every now and then, but I'm not moved by it. I don't go down that street.
Now, I don't need the railway schedule to determine how I'm going to live my
life.
My life is determined by my interaction with nature. Once again, another quote from his journal. He wrote in his journal, "I go a fishing and a hunting every day, but omit the fish and game, which are the least important part." So, imagine that, right? What kind of fisherman and hunter is he? He says he goes fishing and hunting every day, but he never catches anything. He's not interested in catching anything. And he's actually irritated by fishermen and hunters, especially the ice fishermen on Walden Pond, who go out there and want to get the fish. He's like, well, they don't take enough time appreciating nature. What they can learn from nature. I want to just share with you now a little bit in the last closing minutes, a little bit about the context, which might help us understand why he says what he says about why he goes to the woods in 1845. Okay. So here's just a few things to think about as we leave. And he was there in 1845. That he was there for 2 years and 2 months at Walden Pond. Did he stay there all the time?
No.
Was he there solid for 2 years?
No.
You know, someone comes to Walden, comes to Holden. I keep getting these confused. Am I talking about Holden? Am I talking about Walden? Okay. Maybe you'll think about this later in the day. How much is Walden like Holden and Holden like Walden? And he's there for 2 years, but he comes and goes. He goes on trips to Maine. He goes back to have a meal at Emerson's house. He goes to get some more supplies to build his house. He's also very much shaped by Romanticism, by Wordsworth and Goethe, whose work is just flowing into America. He, as we've heard just a few moments ago, has a Harvard education. And there he began to become a disciple of Emerson, who spoke at his Harvard graduation. One of Emerson's most famous speeches was at Harvard, and it was there, it was then that Thoreau graduated. And the ideas are called by American historians and literary scholars transcendentalism. And the basic idea is that you can learn deep truths by looking at nature. He's also very much shaped in reaction against a whole bunch of other things. You can see it just in this excerpt, and you see it fully through the whole book. He does not like what historians call the market revolution. and commerce. This whole economy of buying and selling that's linking people all over the country through canals and also through railways. He doesn't like the Industrial Revolution. It's bringing the railways as well. In fact, he talks about, did you hear the little mention of the Irish workers? There are a bunch of Irish workers who were squatting near Concord while they worked on the railway. They were living in shacks, not unlike his. I wonder even if he got the idea from them, watching how they were living as they built the railways. This is just a year or two after the Irish potato famine, which would bring so many immigrants, new people to America. He's also obviously upset with the communications revolution, doesn't like newspapers. There's a new kind of press in America. It's a stone lithograph, and it can just pump out the news every day. And through the network of railways and canal boats and even steam boats on the rivers, it can disperse this news all over the country very, very quickly. There's also something called the telegraph, which is transforming America. He's also very upset about westward expansion and this kind of disappearing nature in the West. As someone said, made a mention to the Mexican War. Mexican War starts the year after he arrives in Walden. And it will continue a few years. Really, really a terrible war from Thoreau's point of view. You might remember how Thoreau spent a night in jail because he refused to pay taxes. Why did he refuse to pay taxes? Because it was going to support the war, and also it was supporting a country that favored slavery. This is also an age of democratization. So he goes out to Walden to declare his independence. This is very much a part of what American ideas of this time were all about. It's not just Emerson's individualism and self-reliance, but it's also ideas of the individual mattering in America. This is an age of Andrew Jackson, who talked about democracy, an age of Polk, who expanded the country more than any other president. Huge tracts of land. And the big question about that land as America moved westward was, were they going to allow slavery? And it seemed like it might happen, that slavery might not only stay in the South, it might expand westward as well. This totally infuriated Thoreau and almost all of the transcendentalists in New England. And then finally, the book was published in 1854. This is the same year as the Kansas-Nebraska Act, which opened up the idea that maybe slavery could expand westward. It's also a time when America is expanding outward into the world. America signs a treaty with Japan in that year. There's a lot happening in his world. In fact, this is a moment of great ferment in America. And so Walden, in some ways, is a refuge from that change that's going on in America. But it's also, I think, one of the most important books shaping not only other environmental writers, but even in ways we don't even fully know, shaping our own views about nature and perhaps why we go to the woods. I hope you have a good afternoon.
Thank you.